I hope it was sweet for you, or something. I kind of came prepared to give a talk about something, and I could. But as happens sometimes after I sit, it somehow is not there anywhere. You know, it's there, but I can't. You know, it's kind of just floating away. Are there any concerns that you have about meditation or mindfulness or Buddhism that you would like to have addressed this evening?
Would you want to say anything on jealousy and mudita?
Jealousy and mudita. I don't have much interest in talking about jealousy, but mudita I love. Elizabeth, mudita is a wonderful emotion and reaction that we can have to the world around us. And it's, mudita is a Pali word for, usually translated into English as sympathetic joy, appreciative joy. And it belongs to a group of four different emotions or four different reactions or responses or that we can have that are called the Brahma Viharas. And Brahma is the supreme deity of the Indian pantheon, of ancient India. And Vihara means dwelling place. So some people have translated Brahma Viharas as the divine abodes. They are so wonderful, they're just divine. And they're also called sublime. They're also called the unlimited, the boundless abodes. And these are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And these four, see, the practice of mindfulness by itself is a rather wisdom-neutral practice. And what I mean by that is that mindfulness is just a practice of seeing clearly what's going on. When you see clearly what's going on, then you might discover a wise response or wise understanding of what you're looking at. But the mindfulness is just simply the act of seeing clearly. In a sense, mindfulness is no wiser than a window in your house that you've managed to clean really well. Imagine you have a window, your living room window hasn't been cleaned in 35 years. And you wonder if it's dark outside or light outside. You don't really quite know what. And how marvelous it is to actually discover you can clean the window and actually starting to get it clean and to see clearly for the first time. You say, wow, this is fantastic. And then you might decide that your neighbors are really nice people and you finally can see what they look like. But mindfulness is just like a window that we clarify and hold so we can really see things clearly. But it doesn't give us in and of itself any guidance about how to live our lives or what kind of choices to make in our lives. So Buddhists will look for other places for that issue of what do we use to guide our lives, or are there places where we reference points or understandings or virtues or ethical guidelines or whatever that we can use to help make decisions about how we can live our lives. Now, when I first came to Buddhism, I was not interested at all to have any be told by Buddhism how to live my life or how to understand my life or how to help me make my decisions. I was just interested in the meditation practice to help clean the window. But what happens is that if that's all your meditation practice is, which it doesn't have to be any more than that, but what happens then is that the mindfulness may or may not show you, or it may or may not help you, to step outside of the normal decisions or the normal values of the culture you've been growing up in or living in. And so it might actually, for some people, actually, the mindfulness can help them actually become more efficient at certain maladaptive behavior that they've been living for a long time. Occasionally that happens. I'm kind of a little bit surprised sometimes, and maybe I shouldn't be, and maybe I shouldn't even mention this. Maybe it's not fair. But I'm usually a little bit surprised when I hear that there are meditators at the Pentagon. It kind of surprises me when I hear that, because somehow, in my naive mind, I think that maybe that the two kind of activities are incompatible. So what Buddhism offers then is a series of different guidelines or frameworks or ways of understanding to help us in situations, how to make a decision, what's the wise course of action to take in what you see, where you find yourself. And if you really take on the study of Buddhism deeply, which you don't have to do, but some people like to do it, the deep study of Buddhism is valuable, not only because it's valuable in and of itself, but because for most of us, it's a radically different system than the Western cultural system we find ourselves in. And it helps us kind of question some of the deepest assumptions we have about how we live our lives by offering sometimes alternative points of view. Have you ever thought of living this way? Have you ever thought of maybe seeing situations in a little different way? So one of the very important but less radical perhaps suggestions that Buddhism offers for how you can live your life, how you can guide your life, and how what kind of decisions you make are these four Brahma Viharas. If you come to a situation, how do you want to relate to the situation? Do you want to relate to it with jealousy? Do you want to relate to it with hate? Do you want to relate to it with shutting down and becoming numb? Do you want to, you hate with it? You relate to it through aversion, through greed or generosity? There's all these different ways you can choose to relate to what you find. And if you just kind of stumble into your life and clearly see what's there, it might not help you question the automatic reaction, how you want to respond and react. So the Brahma Viharas are guidelines that Buddhists use for their social relationships with other people and with themselves. So the first one, called metta, is loving kindness. And that's the word metta is related to the word for friend. It's a friendly response or a kind response to the situation you find yourself in. To have a feeling of, to be disposed or be interested in having a friendly and kind relationship to the world around you, to your neighbors, and even to yourself. And Buddhists will spend time often cultivating this attitude and this feeling and this intention to go into situations with the intention to be friendly. So you don't just simply go to the Safeway and stand in line to get your cereal. But you also go in there thinking, well, this is an opportunity to be friendly with someone. And maybe I'll be friendly with the person in front of me in the line. We have to stand there for a few minutes. And maybe they don't want to be friendly with you, but at least you're kindly disposed. You don't have to relate. You talk to them. Or you come to the clerk, you know, the checkout clerk. And so you're interested in, you know, you're much more interested in a kind, friendly relationship to your clerk than you are getting your cereal. You know, where's your priorities after all? And so Buddhists then will cultivate this ability to be friendly. And it's not considered easy to do that in all kinds of, you know, in many circumstances. But it's something we don't have to leave to chance or just how we're naturally disposed. But you can cultivate and develop the intention and the possibility of meeting different situations in a friendly way. Cultivating loving kindness. The second one is compassion. Compassion can also be cultivated. Compassion also is a way of responding to a situation. If someone's suffering, then the appropriate response is one of compassion. If you're incapable of compassion when someone else is suffering, Buddhists then will take the mirror of mindfulness and bring it back to themselves and say, wait a minute, this person's suffering. I'm not feeling any compassion for that person. That seems a little bit odd. Since in Buddhism we talk a lot about compassion and the importance of it, let me not criticize myself or beat myself up for it, but let me use this mindfulness to study what's going on with me, the fact that I don't have compassion here. And there's a range of things you might discover. You might discover horrified anxiety. You know, gee, you know, get me away from this. This is just too awful. If I open up to this, then, you know, I don't know if I can handle that level of suffering, or I don't know if I can take responsibility for, you know, I don't know what I'm going to, you know, I don't know where my responsibility is going to kick in if I really take on this person or really feel what this person's feeling. Or perhaps this horrified anxiety because it reminds you of something about yourself that you haven't wanted to look at. Or there's pity. Pity is not the same thing as compassion, if you really pay attention. Pity is having this attitude that you're better than the other person, kind of aloof, and you're looking down, oh, I feel so sorry for you. I wish it could be better. And it's to be the recipient of that, this feels very condescending. Or maybe you feel numb, and so then the mindfulness is to explore the numbness, and why do you feel numb? And then to cultivate compassion. What does it take to develop compassion? What's the understanding that brings compassion? The third one, which Elizabeth brought up, is mudita. And mudita is sympathetic joy, appreciative joy. And that's to have the ability to have appreciation in the joy of others, to share in the joy of others. And it's often related to, in reverse fashion, with jealousy. Because if someone else has something really wonderful happen to them, and you're comparing yourself to that person, measuring yourself to that person, using that person as a kind of some way of looking at yourself, your own wounds and desires or whatever, it can easily give birth to jealousy. So, you know, this is what comes to mind talking about this. When I was in Burma meditating, I had this long retreat in Burma. And there were a number of Westerners practicing there, and we were practicing for long times. I was there for 8 months, 8 month retreat, and other people were there for longer. Very serious, very intense meditation practice. And we hardly ever talked to each other, the Westerners did, but one day somehow I had an occasion to talk to a Westerner. And he kind of looked at me with this, he'd been meditating for a long time by that time, 4 or 5 months, just, you know, and he looked at me and he said, did you hear? Did you hear that so-and-so had reached the first stage of enlightenment? I knew her back in Berkeley. No way, she couldn't have done that. No way, I knew her. And His jealousy had got the upper hand of it. And partly it got upper hand because he was trying so hard to have some deep realization in his own practice. And here is someone who he compared himself to. If it was some Burmese had come to the monastery and gotten enlightened, he would have just, you know, wouldn't have been no deal for him. But the fact that it was someone he knew back from Berkeley, you know, they can all go back home to Berkeley and, you know, she got it, but you didn't? Ha, ha, ha. You know, I don't know what this, you know, he was concerned about his friends. And so he was really jealous. Because I think in part, he'd used that person's experience of realization to have a reflection on who he was. It became a statement of comparison. Oh, that person attained something that I didn't get. And so jealousy or anger or aversion arose. Or sometimes someone else feels that gets something really wonderful happen in their life, and it reminds you of the fact that you feel deprived in your life and nothing happens to you, so you feel jealous of that person. Or you see that the person gets lots of adulation. And it would be nice to get adulated sometimes, wouldn't it? And you haven't been adulated for a few weeks now, and you know, and you kind of miss it, and so, or a few years or whatever. And so there's kind of a jealousy. Jealousy is kind of like wanting what that person has, I suppose. And having some feeling of aversion or anger, animosity to the person for having it. Isn't that a definition of jealousy? Someone have a better one? I just made it up.
There should be a distinction between jealousy and envy.
Oh, what's the difference?
I think that in envy, you want what the other person has, whereas in jealousy, I think you're trying, you want what they have for yourself.
So?
You're trying to prevent. Well, jealousy is where you're trying, is where you don't want the other person to have.
Oh. So envy is you want what the other person wants, has. And Lewis is suggesting that maybe jealousy, let me say it this way. So a subcategory of that, or a different version of that, is that so envy, you want what the other person has.
And
there's another feeling where you want them to stop having it, take it away from them. So if you're envious with someone who has a lot of money, you can just go out and win the lottery and then that takes care of that. But if you are jealous of the person, then there's certainly more animosity built into it, I would think. And that you want to get back at the person or take it away from the person out of spite. You don't necessarily want it for yourself, but you want to destroy it for the person. Is that right? You just want it for yourself. When you're jealous, you want... So
you also maybe you don't see the blessings you do have. You don't see what you do have.
You don't see... Uh-huh. So many things. So yes?
Well, I think you can be happy for the person and still be envious. But when you're jealous, you're not happy.
Oh, so when you're envious, you can be happy.
Because you can be happy for the other person. Uh-huh. And still be envious of what they have. Mm-hmm. But when you're jealous, you're not happy for the other person. No?
Could be, yeah. I mean, all these things are possible, but whether we use the definitions, you know, whether we, you know, what jealousy technically is maybe less important to all the options of how humans feel. But if your partner, you know, has gone off with someone else for a while, and you feel jealous, is that right? What do you think? Not envy. Yeah, you want what they have. Yes.
Jealousy implies an inadequacy within yourself.
Inadequacy?
Inadequacy.
Sometimes you feel hurt when you feel jealous, don't you? But maybe that's not exactly jealousy. Maybe they go together. But maybe it's separate from jealousy. Can you feel jealousy without being hurt?
I don't think so.
What?
I don't think you can.
But you can be. But you can.
It's always in the background.
But you can feel envy without being hurt. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because jealousy is very personal. Where envy could be, you know, I can be envious of the, you know, the king of Saudi Arabia for his wealth.
Right.
But I don't take it personally.
Yeah, envy doesn't have to have a personal standpoint.
Uh-huh. So, yes?
Yeah, I think the way I use it, I think of envy as more toward material things,
uh-huh.
And jealousy maybe more toward emotional things, like jealous of attention or jealous of love, whereas envy seems more like you'd be envious of his money or the car or whatever. At least I think that's the way I use it.
Uh-huh. So like my 3-year-old son, I guess he would say maybe he's jealous of my attention to my mother, to my wife.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of gets in there. Sometimes he literally goes between us and pushes us apart. So mudita is understood to be kind of, I don't know if it's the opposite of jealousy, but they're often kind of paired in this funny way. And mudita is to feel joy in the joy of others. Now, I don't think that necessarily means you're supposed to make out of your way to feel joy in your partner's affair. But I suppose you could. it's a beautiful thing to feel joy in the joy of others. And it's not always so easy for people. Some people find it easier to feel compassion for someone suffering than it is to feel delight and joy in the fact that someone else has succeeded in something in their life and to share in that joy. And the fourth of these responses or emotions is equanimity. And equanimity is probably the least understood, because equanimity lends itself to the idea that you're supposed to be even. It's kind of like an absence of effect of emotion. That, you know, you're just equanimous, it means you're just kind of like no reaction, nothing phases you, nothing bothers you, you're just really cool. And whereas equanimity in the Buddhist tradition is a deeply heartfelt, almost like a heartfelt emotion. It comes with, it's really kind of a powerful strength, a powerful presence within you. It's kind of like you know, you just feel so solid and so big and so whole and healthy and everything, that if someone comes and tells you that you know, they don't like gray sweaters, you know, it doesn't you know, it just doesn't matter. Or if someone tells you they love gray sweaters on men, you know, it just hardly affects you, right? But if you don't have that kind of equanimity, if you feel really insecure and inadequate and just really afraid what people think of you, and you feel like everybody's ready to reject you at a moment, they probably already have, you know, and rejected you, and then someone comes along and says, you know, gray sweaters, not so nice. And it just, you know, it just feels devastating. You take it so personally. There's no equanimity, right? So it's more like, it's not like it's an evenness of mind by, you know, just kind of the, you know, just being plain, or, you know, but it's kind of like a real strength, a real power of energy, of heartfulness that is so much stronger than, that overrides any tendency. Just, you're not going to tend to see anything in that way. Equanimity also arises in relation to other people, what goes on with other people's lives, through the understanding that other people are responsible for their own decisions. Or more in Buddhist language, it said that people, everyone is the inheritors of their own karma. So even though you can feel compassion and want them to be free of their suffering, if you feel responsible for their suffering, then there's very little chance for equanimity. But to feel that you're not responsible for their suffering, by understanding they've inherited the results of their own karma, in traditional Buddhist language, helps you have the kind of healthy distance from them where you don't feel responsible and get sucked in an unhealthy way. It doesn't mean you stay aloof and distant from the person. It just means that you're more balanced about taking care of them. All four of these are meditation, can be done as meditation practices. We train ourselves, we develop these intentions in our meditation practice, so that we don't leave them to chance. Just it would be nice if once in a while these things arose. And there are people in Buddhists who actually spend months and years cultivating these to become real powerful strengths within them. In the our particular meditation tradition, the Vipassana tradition, the one that gets the most attention is loving-kindness. And some people say that loving-kindness is the foundation for the other three. If you develop that, the other three will kind of follow. Loving-kindness is, if a person is neither suffering nor having some great success or happiness in their life, then loving-kindness is just a feeling of tender friendliness, of kindness to that person. If you're friendly to someone and they're suffering, then you're liable to feel compassion for them. If you have a friendly attitude towards someone and they're happy, you're liable to feel joy in their happiness. These things, these four Brahmaviharas, are very helpful and very important as attitudes towards ourselves. Because many people can somehow see the value of this towards other people, and so many of us can have these attitudes towards other people, but there are many people who have none of it towards themselves. And I think probably one of the biggest deficits in America, besides the sleep deficit, is the self-compassion deficit. That I don't think that people have enough self-compassion for themselves. And then with that goes friendliness towards themselves, kind of loving kindness towards themselves, and sympathetic joy. So I know people who have a hard time appreciating their own happiness and success. So I'm raising this three-year-old, and sometimes we have this bed night ritual of listing all the people that love him. So I have this idea, maybe that's nice for him to fall asleep with all these people, you know, circled around by all the people who love him. But he's naming them all, you know. Mommy loves you, Daddy loves you, and just go through the aunt so-and-so and uncle so-and-so and on and on and on it goes. And then I'm trying to introduce him very gently to loving kindness practice by saying, after doing that, we go, you know, Mommy loves you, may Mommy be happy. Uncle Itai loves you, may Uncle Itai be happy. And he seems to like that a lot, doing this. But sometimes I'll ask him, you know, who loves you? And there's a certain way of asking it where he knows what the right answer is. You know, he knows that what I'm trying to get at is, his name is Torin. And he says, Torin loves Torin. May Torin be happy. And the idea being that self-love is a very important quality to have, and that it's allowable, and it has a place in his life, and, you know, and it's completely approved of or accepted or celebrated, the fact that he would have that. And my hope is that it doesn't make him the world's biggest egotist, but rather that, I don't know what kind of effect this is going to have on a three-year-old growing up, but the teaching in Buddhism, at least, is that self-love is an indispensable foundation for being able to love other people. To have loving kindness towards oneself is necessary in order to develop loving kindness towards other people around. So traditionally in Buddhism, loving kindness is cultivated first towards oneself. And then with that foundation, then we extend it to other people. And though occasionally we meet people, I meet people for whom the ability to self-love is so impossible because of the amount of self-hate or whatever, that they need to start with someone else first. And after they get the hang of it with other people, then they turn around and do it towards themselves. Now, these four Brahma-viharas are nowadays, at least here in the West, considered Buddhist practices, Buddhist virtues, and guidance for how to live a life. Scholars who study the Buddhist tradition claim that these are meditation practices and attitudes that existed in India before the time of the Buddha. They were the spiritual traditions of ancient India. These Brahma-viharas were already present. And the Buddha, many of the things that the Buddha adopted into his so-called religion were things that he just chose from the milieu of his religious times. And many of us have lost, you know, especially here in the West, have lost, we don't realize anymore how much what we call Buddhism now was not originally part of Buddhism at all. And the fact that Brahma-viharas were not originally part of Buddhism but predated Buddhism makes me think that I like it very much because then they become more universal. And we don't have to think of them as just being Buddhist things, but rather they're, I like to think of them as just being natural capacities we all have, and we can all develop them. When I first started doing mindfulness meditation, Vipassana, I had done Zen practice for many years. And I was first introduced to Vipassana in Thailand and Burma at the Vipassana centers, where they never did any loving kindness practice. I was never taught it when I was there. And in fact, my teacher in Burma, he made a point of not teaching these things because he really wanted me to just stay with the Vipassana, just follow that as far as it would go. And what I found was, while I was doing this Vipassana practice, that the kind of, it tenderizes the heart or kind of removes some of the barriers towards our capacity for love and joy. And I found myself at times dissolving in phenomenal pools and oceans of love and loving kindness. And whatever arose in my experience, whatever occurred at all in my experience, I would just meet it with this kind of tremendous feeling of love, you know, just, and it would just dissolve into this puddle of whatever. It was a period, a phase of my practice. Not that you have to have that phase. It's not like it's necessary or anything, but
can we sign up for it?
And then, Now, don't get jealous now either. This is a time for sympathetic joy. And then I went, came back to America and continued my Vipassana practice here. And the retreat center where I practiced, they started teaching. But halfway through the retreat, they started teaching loving kindness meditation. And having been this, you know, stern Zen student, you know, this kind of ascetic approach to religious life, I thought it was really kind of saccharine-like, this, you know, emphasize on loving kindness and may you be happy, may you be safe and healthy. And I also felt it was artificial. The idea that you would kind of suddenly feel friendly or feel loving kindness, you know. I thought, I just kind of took it that that only happened by accident or just happened just spontaneously given circumstances. And it wasn't something you cultivated. So when my teachers started doing these meditations on loving kindness, I just tuned them out. You know, it wasn't for me. I was a Zen student, thank you. And then started, and the same thing started happening on my retreat here in America. I started having these strong, somewhat spontaneously through the meditation, these strong experiences of loving kindness would arise by itself. Because I think it often happens as a result of Vipassana practice. And then when the teachers came to do loving kindness practice, I already had it. And I knew exactly what they were talking about. And then it just became, just augmented what I was already feeling and my attitude I already have. And then I got really into it. And now I don't think of the loving kindness practice as something artificial, but I see it rather as kind of an awakening of something which is often, with a potential which is within me, within my heart, that is really beautiful and something I delight in. And I'm very happy to do loving kindness practice now. So does that approximately answer your question? It's in the ballpark. You want to ask more specifically your concern?
I mean, I had just been thinking a lot about mudita, and also I guess you also mentioned about just having the wish of being aware of our own, you know, our own goodness or blessings, and you know, the wish that we not be separated from them. And I've just been thinking about it, and I hadn't heard that many talks on mudita specifically.
Reminds me of a story of a friend of mine who went to India. He was a long-time Vipassana practitioner, very serious and very much involved and very mature in his spiritual life. And he went to India, and he visited an Indian guru. And he asked the guru something like, how he could find grace, or where was grace to be found? And the guru laughed and laughed and laughed, and he said something like, you're neck deep in grace, and you're asking where it is? And it was very important for this, my friend. The fact that he lived in America where he was very relatively comfortable and in years of spiritual practice and certain level of maturity in his practice. The fact that he didn't go with other spiritual friends to India and visit this famous guru. And he had all these wonderful fortuitous circumstances that allowed him to do all these things. And the teacher, you're neck deep in grace. The fact that you're here, you know, and you don't even see it. Many of us don't see the benefits and the grace of our lives. There's so much of it. There's so much that supports our lives and make it possible that it's really remarkable that we don't just, you know, celebrate more often. But most of us don't really focus that much on what is going right in our life, because often we take it, unless it's suddenly gone right, because we take it for granted. Like we deserve it or supposed to be this way. And maybe we grew up this way. You know, we grew up and we're supposed to have supermarkets filled with abundant vegetables. And no one thinks about this as being, you know, it's like one of the most remarkable achievements of humankind, the fact that we can have fresh vegetables all year round by just going into Safeway. I mean, and when's the last time you went to Safeway and kind of celebrated this variety of choice and how easy it was, you know? And wow, how could I have been so lucky to be born here at this time in this place and have so much? Rather, you kind of grumble because they don't have the right brand of, you know, they have graham crackers, but they don't have the cinnamon graham crackers, which you know, they have cinnamon graham crackers, but they don't have low fat cinnamon graham crackers. You know, and I'm going to talk to the supervisor manager of this, you know, how could it be this way? And you leave in a huff, you know, and because we often focus on the cutting edge of our desires and cutting edge of what the problem is and the cutting edge of our definition of self and what we think we need. And it doesn't take much suffering to begin appreciating what now we take for granted. So I think most of us live in states of grace. And the amazing thing is we don't know it.
Is that the same as gratefulness?
Grace? It could be. Grateful. Grace is a Christian term, I guess. Grace means... what does grace mean? I guess it means feeling of tremendous blessing. A lot of luck or benefit or welfare. There's tremendous welfare, tremendous good blessings, tremendous auspiciousness, tremendous support and help that our life is being given. A lot of beauty that's coming into our lives.
That's the same as like being thankful or being grateful.
I would hope that they're almost the same. I hope that grace is connected to the word, Latin word, I believe, the Latin word for free. Grazie in Italian means thank you. Maybe it's also related to thanks. To say grace, it means to express your thankfulness.
But to talk about being in a state of grace seems like more like being the recipient of
right.
Some blessing.
Right.
The grace of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, yeah. External yeah. Blessing. Yeah, be recipient of something, some other support. And
it's kind of a lack of fear.
Mm-hmm. Lack of fear, yeah.
Sense of ease, like graceful.
Yeah. Yes.
Often thought that, you know, our environment in general, you know, just America has been based so much on comparisons or competition. I think from very early on that it's just, you get the feeling it's not okay to be where you are, that you have to always be achieving something else in order to feel great.
Yeah.
To be in that state, so the focus, it doesn't feel comfortable to just be where you are.
Because we're so envious of those people who made it. Striving.
So, so loving kindness, sympathetic joy, compassion. Compassion is very important. In Mahayana Buddhism, compassion is the most important social emotion, whereas in Theravadan Buddhism, loving kindness is considered the most important. And I'm not going to, you know, who's to say who's right, which is most important, but compassion is very, very important. And so there are times when we can celebrate in sympathetic joy and feeling the grace and benefits of our lives. And there are times when a feeling of empathy and concern for the welfare and the suffering of others is really what's called for in a different situation. As we become freer, as the mindfulness practice becomes stronger, then hopefully the person becomes more flexible so they can respond appropriately in these different categories, different ways, depending on what the circumstances are. Yes?
Are these basically skills, or would you attach other ideas and concepts to them?
They could be seen as skills. I like to think of them as intentions, because if they're intentions, they don't have to be feelings. Because you can have the intention to be kind towards someone, but you might not feel kindly towards them. But it's your intention, it's your wish that you could have that. And when we do loving kindness practice, we're trying to water the seed of that intention. We're not necessarily trying to make ourselves feel loving or kind. That might come as a byproduct. And in the long term, the benefits come from watering the seed of intention, not from cultivating the feeling. Right. The loving kindness practice is the practice of cultivating that intention. So every day, if a person does loving kindness practice every day will cultivate that intention. And often, the acts of loving kindness and feelings of loving kindness come in the wake of the intention. But the intention is most important. Because if the intention is strong, then you might find yourself in a situation where you feel really angry with someone. And then that little intention says, oh, you know, I really would like that person to be well and happy, even though the person's a jerk. You know, and so somehow, and then you're kind of surprised, by yourself. Oh, I seem to have this new little, wiggling little attitude in there I never used to have around these kinds of people. And then you have to choose which one that you want to follow through on. I read on Monday night one night. The story of it's been going around ever since September 11th. So maybe you've heard it about. I've heard it in two different versions. One was a Native American grandfather, and one was an Indian grandfather talking to his grandson, and he says something like, inside of me, there are two wolves. One wolf is the wolf of anger and hate and vengeance. And the other wolf is the wolf of kindness, compassion, generosity. And they're in a great struggle inside of me for supremacy. And the grandson says, which one is going to win? And the grandfather says, whichever one I feed. Mm-hmm. So to have accessible that intention close at hand allows a person to feed it in a helpful way. If it hasn't been cultivated, it's not accessible close at hand, it can't, it's difficult to feed it and develop it. So the skill, you ask if it's a skill. The skill, the intention is not a skill. The skill is learning how, in a healthy way, to strengthen that intention. The skill is how to recognize that intention when we need it, and how to then proceed from there. Yes?
Is there, meditation is loving kindness, do you approach it in a different way? Compared to compassion?
Yeah, the different phrases.
But you're focusing on your breath, so what does it mean?
You don't actually focus on your breath when you do loving kindness practice. Let's do it. I'll guide you through loving kindness, short loving kindness meditation. Take a few deep breaths, long, slow, deep breaths. And as you exhale, relax your body, your mind, your thoughts. And then take a couple of more long, slow, deep breaths. But now breathe into the area of your heart center, center of your chest, and fill it up. And then let your breath return to normal. And take a few moments to feel the area around your heart. There's no right or wrong sensations there. But just feel that area. Become familiar with it. And have or imagine that your breath comes in and out through that area. And then take a few moments to think kind thoughts towards yourself. Just in whatever way you want, just kind of think kindly towards yourself. As if you're your own friend. And see if you can find within yourself the wish for your own happiness. You don't have to be happy right now. But the idea within you that it would be a good idea if you could be happy. That happiness is nice. And there's a wish for happiness to be part of your life, a greater part of your life. Maybe you can remember some times in life that you were happy. And think, oh yeah, it would be nice to be happy now. So the very simple wish for your own happiness without expectation that you can succeed at it, without demand that it should be so. Kind of open-ended wish. And now taking this wish or this intention for your own well-being and happiness, I'm going to say certain phrases of loving kindness out loud, and then you can silently repeat them to yourselves, a whisper in your mind. And each time you say them, use these phrases and kind of sink into the intention. Let it be water to nourish this wish or this intention within you. If you feel no intention for your own happiness, then be open to the possibility that it might arise. So these are the phrases. May I be happy. May I be filled with joy. May I be at ease. May I be peaceful. Perhaps feeling tenderness within yourself, or gentleness, or kindness. Perhaps not. But allowing for this intention for your happiness to grow. May I be happy. May I be filled with joy. May I be at ease. May I be peaceful. Some people do loving-kindness practice and completely forget about their breathing, paying attention to it. And some people find it's nice to coordinate the phrases with the breathing. Some people like to say, may I be on the in-breath, and then happy on the out-breath. And in doing loving-kindness meditation and using these phrases, it can be very helpful to have a steadiness about it, have a steady, ongoing quality of being connected to this possibility, this wish of happiness through these phrases. May I be happy. May I be filled with joy. May I be at ease. May I be peaceful. The loving-kindness practice can have a tenderizing effect on our hearts. The armor of the heart dissolves a little bit. And sometimes the opposite of loving-kindness has a chance to surface if it's buried there. Some people will do this practice and feel sadness or anger or rage, grief. It's fine for that to happen. It just means the heart is opening up. And you can either continue with loving-kindness practice or stop it for a while and do basic mindfulness towards what you're feeling. And then the practice is also done towards other people. And usually after doing it to yourself, you choose someone who cares about you. Traditionally, it's said to be a benefactor, someone who's been a benefactor in your life. Helped you, a teacher, for example, or a parent, or a friend. I like to think of it as someone who cares about you. Maybe in your mind's eye, you can remember or imagine that person happy. Maybe a time when they were happy. Smile on their face. And then you connect to the wish within yourself that that person could be happy, continue to be happy, grow in happiness. And then with that simple wish, you repeat the following phrases. May you be happy. May you be filled with joy. May you be at ease. May you be at peace. And then the loving kindness meditation can develop by expanding loving kindness, the wish for happiness, out to different categories of people and other people, and until finally the loving kindness practice is done for all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy. May all beings be filled with joy. May all beings be at ease. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings everywhere be happy.